So I was away. We had a week of training for a whole, like about 90 people that are coming from the United States, Mexico, Canada, and abroad that are in training to teach the Dharma, to teach these practices. And basic inquiry that we have, that's really the inquiry, is really what allows us to wake up, to heal, to wake up from a kind of a trance of separateness and feeling oppressed and like something's wrong, into the fullness of what we are, what really works. And I was remembering that this was the question that was kind of the main current of a tricycle conference. Tricycle is a Buddhist magazine that sponsored a big Buddhist conference, all the different traditions. And it was held 3 weeks before 9/11 in the Twin Towers. And I was asked to be one of five opening presenters, and the other four were real elders in the tradition. I was the newbie, and I was really self-conscious and nervous about that. And then I found out I was going second, and I thought, good, at least I'll have a chance to kind of relax and gather myself and sense, you know, reflect a little. And the first person got up to speak, and his name is Baker Roshi. Some of you might know Suzuki Roshi's Dharma Heir. And so I'm sitting back waiting for, you know, him to address this question of what really works. And he got up and he said, two things, intention and attention. And then he bowed and he sat down. And I went... And internally, I went, oh, shit. Because it was like, okay, I'm on. And it's like, I did not have my collecting time. So I got up there and I went, okay, intention. Well, my intention, you know, be real, be here. And then attention, just what's happening, you know. And I have no idea what I said. And, you know, by the way, we were told we had 10 minutes. So that's another reason I was so shocked. Intention and attention. So this is really what we're going to be exploring tonight, is intention and attention. And it's what we explored in this week of training, and one of the most basic kind of understandings that we were developing, there are scads of meditation techniques. The more we're around, the more we find out there's what the Buddha called I think it was 80,000 skillful means. There's all these different ways of paying attention so that you can have different experiences. The ground of them all, presence. Awake, open, here-ness. You know, noticing and allowing just what's here, presence. What allows us to have presence is a quality of heart. It's that we care. It's that we have an intention to be here. Not one of us would be here unless there was some kind of longing or intention of the heart to wake up. It drives all of spiritual awakening. This kind of longing, this caring about spiritual freedom. So there's another word I'd like to use with intention, which is the word devotion. And in a way, it's in the West, it's in the Buddhist worlds in the West. The American Buddhists don't use it very much. It's kind of a very intimate word. And yet, it's such an important word, because devotion really means to give ourselves fully to what we love. And the truth about the path is that the more we wake up, you know, the more we learn to be here, the more we care about being here, the more devoted we are to presence. And then the more devoted we are to presence, the more we wake up. So it's a kind of a circular thing. But that caring, that loving presence, loving to be here, is what keeps us kind of energized on the path. It's sometimes called the juiciness of the path. It's very dry if we think we're just training in a technique to like be with the breath or something. But when we realize it's really not about being with the breath, it's about being here where awareness and love really are alive, then it has some vividness and vitality to it. So there's different faces to devotion. When we talk about devotion, this deep intention of the heart, it takes different ways of presenting. For some, our devotion comes through in this kind of loving to serve, just really loving to help. For others, it's a passion about the truth. That devotion is like, I want to know what's true. I want to know what's real. What is real? That's the aliveness of devotion. So for some, it's an awe and a wonder at nature, the mystery of the natural world. And we're really devoted to that, cherishing that. And for many, it's in loving others that we feel our devotion and our real caring for others. And for many of us, it's a lot of these. But the flag of devotion is sincerity. When there's a purity of the heart, when we really are connected with what matters to us, the way we know it is that there's a feeling of sincerity. It's like, oh, I'm home. This feels real. This feels like who I am. And when we're with someone else on the path, and we have an antenna out for sincerity, we trust people when we feel they're sincere. We trust them. I know for myself, with, you know, as I've been through the decades going to different spiritual teachers, what really lets me know is that quality of sincerity, what I can trust. And we also have an antenna out for falseness. You know, we can kind of sense when people are going through the motions and spouting out religiosity and there's not a heart that really cares. Somebody sent me this thing of kids in church, and a Sunday school teacher asked her children as they were on the way to the service, "And why is it necessary to be quiet in church?" One bright little girl replied, "Because people are sleeping." So there's one energy to devotion, and it comes in many flavors, but there's a sincere caring. Maybe before I go on, just a sense for yourself. We'll do a few different reflections tonight, but just take a moment to let your attention go inside. And if we can step outside of the baggage that sometimes comes with the word devotion and just sense it as meaning what we really give ourselves to, what we love that we give ourselves to in the spiritual path, what it is we care about. And just sense for yourself when you're most sincere and most in touch in a deep way with your heart. How does this quality of caring or of devotion express for you? Does it express through your relationships, a real sense of devotedness to the love with another? Does that devotion express in serving, that you really, really want to soothe the suffering of others? Does it express in spiritual practice that there's a real passion to know what's true, to realize really what you are, to live from that sacredness? We'll continue just exploring really how devotion arises in us, what really arouses it. But just to say, in the Buddhist tradition, in a formal way, devotion is expressed in taking refuge. And that means really, in a simple way, that there's an in-loveness with awareness itself, and that's called the Buddha, with loving awareness. And sometimes the devotion can be expressed towards the figure of the Buddha historically, but it really, in the deepest way, is that we're devoted to that awakeness and love that is our essence. So that's the first kind of expression of devotion. And the second is that we're devoted to Dharma, which means path, which means anything that helps us wake up and come home to what we are. So there's a sense of caring about that. And the third, and these are all interrelated, expression of devotion is to the Sangha, which is this field of relationship. That there's a kind of devotion or being in love with loving, with connection. And I find that when I look at other cultures and other religious traditions, there are different expressions of these kind of universal ways of feeling care. But they come out with different flavors, and it's really delicious to sense the different ways people feel devotion. I was teaching a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock some years ago, and one of the women I was doing interviews with, an African-American woman, she's beautiful, she's a grandmother. She had a handful of grandchildren, maybe like six or seven, passionate, eclectic woman. And she came into this interview, and it was 3.5 weeks into a 4-week retreat. And she was glowing, like, you know, just beaming. And so I kind of said something like, so what is happening for you? You know, because she was really beaming. And she said, well, I went to church this morning. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you went to church? You know, like, that's not retreat protocol, okay? You know, this is not what you do on a silent retreat. But I just, my whole thing is radical acceptance. So I said, oh, so you went to church, eh? And she said, yeah, I went to church this morning. And she goes on, she goes, we were all singing. It was gospel. It was sweet. It was divine. We were singing. We were swaying. We were dancing in the spirit of Jesus. And she said, here I am now. And Jesus is in this meditation shawl. Jesus is wrapped around me. And she's just glowing and beautiful. And she says, I'm home, you know. And she was. And I could feel both the intention, the devotion, like in love with being awake and here and fully intentional and committed to that. And the attention that she was right there with how it was happening. Intention and attention. So we continued some, and it was about, you know, right before she left, I realized that she had gone to church in an inner way. It took me a while, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter if she had gone to church or somewhere else. If she had left retreat for a week, it wouldn't have mattered. The point was that we each have our pathways home. And we have different symbols and archetypes and so on that represent loving presence that carry us home. I want to read to you from John O'Donohue, who talks so beautifully about devotion. He says, why do we need to belong? Why is this desire so deeply rooted in every heart? The longing to belong seems to be ancient, at the core of our nature. Though you may often feel isolated, it is the nature of your soul to belong. The soul can never be separate. Its eternal dream is intimacy and belonging. We long to belong because we feel the lonesomeness of being individuals, yet deep within us, we long to come in from separation and be at home again in the embrace of a larger belonging. So the truth is the belonging. The truth is wholeness, is oneness. And each of us feels that pain of separation when we forget who we are. And then there's this longing to come back to belonging again. Different ways back. But that longing is a kind of the tenderness of devotion. And the process is over and over again letting go of our small self into some larger belonging. In some way surrendering into a larger belonging. So it's important to know that this kind of devotion, this remembering what matters and giving ourselves to what matters, evolves over time. It evolves and matures, and there's immature versions of caring and devotion, and there's more and more mature ones. And that the more we pay attention, what's happening? Can I allow this? Like a deep presence, the more the quality of our caring gets more mature. We get clearer as to what we care about. I bring this up because when we're not mindful, when we're caught in the trance, our daily trance, what we get devoted to is kind of narrow. We get caught in a self story that says, something's missing, something's wrong with me, I need something else to feel good. And then our devotion contracts and fixates on getting approval. We get devoted to getting approval. We get devoted to figuring things out. We get devoted to controlling other people. In other words, that purity gets contracted into, in some way, managing our life versus surrendering. Another one from kids in church. A little boy was overheard praying, Lord, if you can't make me a better boy, don't worry about it. I'm having a real good time like I am. And then a three-year-old, our Father who does art in heaven, Harold is his name. So I'm talking about a little bit of immature devotion, or when it gets fixated on something more of which is the agenda of the small self. And the flag of that is that what we love is out there, it's down the road, it's an ideal. In other words, we're devoted to something that's not here and a part of our own being. That's the flag of immature devotion. And the problem with it, it's not like it's bad, it's just that it reinforces a sense of an insufficient self. It reinforces the notion that the divine does not live through this body, heart, mind, it's somewhere else. So we'll explore that a little more. Mature devotion is giving ourselves to the loving awareness that really is our very essence. And when we feel separate from that, it's skillful to find some expression of loving awareness that we can reflect on, bring our attention to, that helps us reconnect with the presence that's always and already here. One of the practices I did a lot for many years was chanting, where we would chant and the mantras would be two different forms and deities that expressed loving presence and really were expressions of our own awakened heart. Now, I didn't chant Hare Krishna, but Ram Dass, who many of you have heard of, Baba Ram Dass, was telling a story about a gathering that he had in his barn in New England, right as part of his parents' property. And he had about 30 people chanting, you know, the Hare Krishna chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Hare, Rama Rama. And they were chanting it over and over, very devotional. His father walks in. He's just standing there kind of looking, and finally they stop and he goes, who is this Hare Krishna? I mean, who is this guy? And the song's nice, but over and over, enough already, you know. So it's like, Hare Krishna. And it was beautiful the way Ram Dass described it, because, you know, they're using a chant and it's chanting to a Hindu god, but it's really chanting to the love that's in our own heart to wake it up. We each have our own pathway to a very kind of pure devotion. And as I said, for some it has that, the expression is that we just love truth, and we love truth more than we love being in our trance. So we're willing to really sit and face our life. And for others, it has that flavor of we love being in love. So we just keep calling on loving and having the courage to be vulnerable. Many different ways. My sequence of devotion, it started in, as many people were, my earliest feelings of devotion were to other people. And again, it was filled with the shadow side of I was devoted and I wanted things back, like approval, you know. And I was trying to prove myself and try to accomplish in order to belong, whether it was with friends or at school or in spiritual community in the early days. My devotion at one point was very fixed on, I was very active, social activist and very much into the ideals of leftist politics. And so I was completely devoted to that, giving my lifeblood to that. And that was another, it had a kind of a real sincerity on one level, but it was also filled with striving and delusion and so on. Then I joined the ashram, spiritual community, and my next kind of focus of devotion was to altered states of consciousness. Whereas I would practice a kind of concentrative meditation, using mantras and a samadhi kind of meditation where the mind gets very concentrated and absorbed, and there's lots of peace and tranquility and bliss and rapture. And that to me was the new God or focus of my devotion, was to achieve those states. Of course, I'd get blissed out and then stop meditating and it would go away. And then I'd have to go back the next morning and meditate again to have it happen. So it was dependent on striving, a kind of meditative striving. But so it was a more narrowed form of devotion. When I got drawn to Buddhism, it was because something in me really felt a yearning to come home in a deeper way. So I wasn't fixating my devotedness on having certain states, but rather really unconditional presence. And that was when things began to open, that rather than being devoted to a certain experience, the devotion was to opening to whatever's here. The devotion was to that openness, that wakefulness and love that really is our essence. And any weather system can go through that. It doesn't matter. And that just is the process that keeps deepening. But there are times that, like all of us, that there's a real sense of separateness from that. And then I'll use something that represents or expresses loving presence as a way to come back home, because I'm not feeling it inside me then. Does that make sense? In the moments I'm not feeling it here, I'll reflect and invoke, for me it's kind of the Divine Mother, a sense of the sacred feminine, where I'll sense a field of loving presence, and I'll call on that, and I'll feel it surrounding me, and I'll kind of offer my being into it. Not trying to get rid of my being into it, but feeling what's here and just really letting it be held by a larger belonging. And the more there's presence and surrendering, the more there's a re-realization that that loving presence is what I am, that it's not external to me. In psychology, this is called having a transitional object, really. And if we fixate on the object and think it's outside us and that we're nothing and it's everything, we can stay arrested for ages. But if there's presence, this is the whole thing with mature devotion. If the devotion is combined with presence, an honest presence, we discover that the object of devotion is really our own awakeness. We'll come back again. What really matters in these pathways to the devoted heart is the sincerity, that we really, really are sincere. This is a Tibetan story. There was an old woman whose son was a trader. He often joined caravans and traveled on business to far spots in India. When his mother learned that her son was going to be near Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha became enlightened, she asked him to bring her a relic from there, something she could use as a focus for her devotion. Her son went to the holy place, and when he returned to his mother, he realized he had forgotten her request. Seeing a dead dog on the street, he tore a tooth from its mouth and wrapped it in silk. When he presented the tooth to his mother, he told her it was one of the Buddha's canine teeth. It was a true holy relic. The old woman put the tooth on her altar and began praying and prostrating before it. Soon the tooth began to emanate countless tiny pearls and rainbows bounced around the room. The old woman, for the first time in her life, found the unshakable peace of mind that she had always sought. And when she died soon after, an aura of rainbow light surrounded her, a sign that she had attained enlightenment. So what do you make of that? It doesn't matter the object. If we trust that there is some loving presence in this universe and we let whatever form be the vessel through which we experience it, if we give ourselves to that, we discover what's always and already here, which really is our own awakened heart-mind. So the practice, and I would like to kind of explore the practices that awaken a kind of genuine devotion, have two qualities: remembering what we care about and honest attention. If it's just remembering what we care about, and it's prayerful, but it doesn't have a clarity and a presence, we get caught in the shadow side. It's out there, it's not me, it's somewhere else. If we're just being clear and noticing what's happening, but there's not a quality of caring, not a quality of heart, there can be in a subtle way a kind of striving and a sense of doing a technique, but not really living a life. Intention and attention. So the first and most basic practice for arousing this quality of a kind of a liberating devotion is the simple reflection on aspiration. It's what we do here at the beginning of class. And the question is really, what matters that we just keep asking our heart? Now here's the challenge. If I say to you, okay, what really matters? What do you really care about? For most of us, initially, we do some prepackaged thing, something we've already figured out that we care about. Those words run through. Or else we hit a blur, you know, just kind of a defocused kind of fuzz, you know. But our heart's not really resonating with something. So the practice of reflecting on aspiration takes time and attention. You can't connect with your aspiration unless you pay attention. Intention and attention are absolutely interdependent. For myself, when I sit each morning, I begin with my palms together because there's something, whatever the energetic physicality of it is, there's something that lets go of a self into just a very simple, sincere, caring place. And I sit there with my palms together with the question, what is it I really care about? What really matters? And I sometimes sit for 15 minutes, the first 15 minutes of my sitting, with my palms together because I am just waiting until I drop in and drop in and drop in. So it's not just words. It's so that my heart is viscerally feeling, oh, I care about presence, which is really like saying I care about what I really am, awareness. I care about inhabiting the truth of what I am, not being in a trance, not being in a story of a self, not trying to alter my state of mind, but a radical kind of presence, our truth, that's really what I am. And when that becomes visceral, I usually relax my hands down just because that's what's next. One of the reflections that helps me with aspiration is the reflection on impermanence. Anyone that has a brush with their mortality, anyone that has experienced the loss of someone they care about, knows how it jogs us into being more in touch with what matters. It can go away, it can fade again. We can get rehooked into our trance. It's like Don Juan says in the Carlos Castaneda books, when death taps us on the left shoulder, all our pettiness falls away. So sometimes the reflection, well, if I was at the end of my life and looking back, what would really matter? Or even what I'll ask myself, just to really kind of put myself on the spot, is, okay, if I was going to die in 3 minutes, and I try to get it as real as possible, what would matter in these 3 minutes? And what would matter would be, in some way, I'd want to call on loving presence. I'd want to surrender into loving presence. I'd want to know my very nature as loving presence. That's what's big enough to hold death and life and this whole universe. And it's truth. So this is the first practice, an authentic reflection on what matters. And let's just practice together for a few moments, and then we'll go on to the next one. You might want to just kind of move your body around in your chair and just feel in that movement a little bit of stretching and adjusting and re-enter your body if you've left it. And then as you settle into stillness, just take a few really full breaths. Breathing yourself into this kind of energetic aliveness. Feel yourself here. You might sense the half smile of the Buddha, that just slight smile that helps to reconnect in a gentle way with the life that's here. Soften the eyes. You might let the hands be very soft, easy. And feel the heart soft. Just let the breath be filled gently at the heart. And again, the inquiry, what do I really care about? If I was at the end of my life looking back, what really matters about this life? If you just had a few moments or minutes, what would be most important? If you have words come up, you might just sense, well, what would that give me? Just to keep inquiring, not with your mind, but with your body and heart, to what most feels alive. What is it you really most love? And ask yourself again, what do you really most love, most cherish? Becoming that loving. Be that loving. So if all that happened as you left here, and maybe a few more times each day or even each week, you took enough time to really ask yourself what mattered, you'd come home more to the truth of what you are and live more from the truth of what you are. It's a homecoming. I'd like to move to one other way that we awake up that sense of, that's very related, which is wakeful prayer. That there are times, as I mentioned, that we're feeling really separate from what we love. In fact, all of our suffering, no matter what's going on in your life, if you're suffering, there's a sense of separation. If you're suffering, there's a sense of disconnection from your own heart or your body or others. And so one response to that that deepens a sense of heart and presence is prayer. And we all pray. Every one of us, when things are tough, on some level we're saying, oh, please may it be such and such, may such and such happen, may it get better. We all do it. And when we're unmindful, the prayer is this reflex. We're wanting something, we're fearing something. So that's, again, not mature prayer. It's not bad, it's just not mature. Some of you remember one of my favorite little stories about prayer. A lady approaches her priest and tells him, Father, I have a problem. I have two female talking parrots, but they only know how to say one thing. What do they say? The priest inquired. They only know how to say, hi. We're prostitutes. Want to have some fun? Ooh, that's terrible, the priest exclaimed. But I have a solution to your problem. Bring your two female parrots over to my house, and I'll put them with my two male talking parrots, whom I taught to pray and to read the Bible. My parrots will teach your parrots to stop saying that terrible phrase, and your female parrots will learn to praise and worship and pray. Thank you, the woman responded. The next day, the woman brings her female parrots to the priest's house. His two male parrots are holding rosary beads and praying in their cage. The lady puts her two female parrots in with the male parrots. Immediately, the female parrots say, hi, we're prostitutes. Want to have some fun? One male parrot looks over at the other male parrot and exclaims, put the beads away. Our prayers have been answered. So, like devotion in general, prayers get fixated in narrow ways or not. Now, here's one of my favorite quotes from D.H. Lawrence. He says, men are not free doing just what they want. Men are only free when they're doing what the deepest self likes. And there's getting down to the deepest self. It takes some diving. So, with prayer, our prayer might start out fixated, like, please help me, or take away this pain, or get me what I want. But if it's a liberating kind of prayer, then if we're bringing attention to what's happening, in other words, mindfulness, presence, it drops to coming from a much deeper place. So rather than prayer that is driven by want or fear, it becomes prayer that's really an expression of that soul longing to come home, to belonging. How does that happen? Maybe share with you, I'm reading a book by Jan Fraser, who's a writer and very awakened being. She lives in Massachusetts. And she spent a number of years grappling with the threat of breast cancer. She had several biopsies, and she was, when she was told that she had to have yet another, she freaked. She had two children that were still nursing at that time, two children nursing. And she describes having, you know, hearing the call and going out into the woods and standing in this rain and just opening to layer after layer of the fear. And so it wasn't like she just went and said, oh, please make it go away, but she just opened to the fear and opened to the grief about not possibly not living to see her children grow up. She describes how prayer arrived from that deep presence with the fear and the grief. It wasn't that she was running away from it. It's like she dropped in. It's like sinking our roots deep into where the pain is. And out of that, the purity of the prayer arises. Now, in this case, she offered her prayer to Guru Maya, who some of you might know of, who's an Indian guru, who many have found to be a very beautiful expression of the Divine Mother. So she invoked her presence. She invoked Guru Maya and called on her loving wisdom. Much in the way I described, is calling on that presence. And I want to read you what she wrote. She said, "Oh Guru Maya, oh my beloved, I could do this. I could have this biopsy and be okay. I could face even the prospect of death if I didn't have children." Then she says, "I shut my eyes, tilted my head back, and let the water come over my eyelids, drip from my lashes, follow the curve of my cheekbones. As though she were there next to me, standing in the downpour with her holy feet on the moss, in silk the color of fire, she said, 'You must be okay, even though you have children.' I almost heard her say it. Felt it as if the words were vibrations inside my chest." What happens in such a moment? We give external form to what we can't quite realize we know within ourselves, within our fragile, deeply wise selves. I put the words into Guru Maya's voice, clothed them in silk, made external what knowing I had within. So this is an example of what you might call an awakened kind of prayer. We'll all still go around saying, "Oh, please, can I, you know, get rid of this or get that or win that or get a parking space or whatever it is we're praying for." But there's a way, if we want to really deepen our sense of devotion, that we feel the pain of separation, and rather than in a reflexive way saying, "Help," you know, it's a mindful help that comes from really deep in our hearts, that sense of being with the pain and the grief. I love the image of the roots of our awareness going deep into the earthiness of the pain, and yet we're like a tree reaching out and inward to the divine. So it's both attention and also that longing. John O'Donohue, he says, "Prayer is the voice of longing. It reaches outwards and inwards to unearth our ancient belonging." A little more from John O'Donohue. He says, "One of the most tender images is the human person at prayer. When the body gathers itself before the divine, a stillness deepens. The blaring din of distraction ceases, and the deeper tranquility within the heart envelops the body. To see people at prayer is a touching sight. For a while they have become unmoored from the grip of society, work, and role. It is as if they have chosen to enter into a secret belonging carried within the soul. They rest in that inner temple, impervious to outer control or claiming. So I'm speaking of prayer because when he says it's touching to see someone in prayer, it's because of the sincerity. It's because you can sense that person coming home and it's very intimate. And in the same way, when we're feeling that pain of separation, to bring our palms together and feel in some way the pain and the longing helps us to come home to a truth of belonging. It's very beautiful. I like the way Jan put it, though, that we might be praying to something that seems external. You know, what are we praying to anyway? I grew up Unitarian, and the big joke there was that Unitarians address their prayers to whom it may concern. You know? They also say that Moses gave the 10 suggestions. You know, so that's my background. But I like the way Jan put it, that she says that we give external form to what we can't quite realize we know within ourselves. So we might call on God or Jesus or Guru or Bodhisattva. And as I mentioned, I said transitional object. It's because we already know that wisdom and love and we're invoking it, right? We feel a little disconnected inside. But our intent is really pure, so we invoke it, and that helps carry us home back to the truth of what we know. So I define devotion as giving ourselves to what we love. And what happens is that we kind of release this preoccupation of self, our stories, into something bigger. For me, there's sometimes an image of almost taking the fear and the stories and the unworthiness and kind of offering it, not to get rid of it, but offering it into some larger truth. Rediscover some bigger sense of belonging. And when we release it, when we're not so bound to this idea of a small separate self, there's a whole lot of space. Devotion gives us a lot of space. When we give ourselves to what we love, whether it's in our love for another person, in an act of generosity, in a sense of prayerfulness, when we give ourselves into something larger, space opens up. There's a lot of clutter in there with the selfing, you know, this figuring out what I need and how I'm going to get more comfortable and how I'm going to prove something or how I'm going to avoid things going wrong. When that is kind of surrendered into something larger, there is this space, and into that space flows joy. Flows a profound kind of peacefulness and ease. When mature devotion arises, a real sense of giving over into something larger, it goes hand in hand with the wisdom of emptiness. We realize that that small self was an idea, and we realize there's no solid entity in here. There's just a belonging. It's empty and it's full. In the Christian tradition, the phrase God, whose love and joy are everywhere, can't come and visit us unless we aren't there. God, whose love and joy are everywhere, can't come and visit us unless we aren't there. So this is kind of the surrendering. We notice what's happening and we let go over and over again. And what rushes in is a kind of not only a joy but a real appreciation. And it doesn't matter what the weather is, an appreciation for life, a real celebration. At one point, Maurice Sendak, the children's illustrator, was asked the question to share favorite comments from readers. This was his response. Oh, there's so many. Can I give you just one I really like? It was from a little boy. He sent me a charming card with a little drawing. I loved it. I answer all my children's letters, sometimes very hastily, but this one I lingered over. I sent him a postcard and I drew a picture of a wild thing on it. I wrote, "Dear Jim, I loved your card." Then I got a letter back from his mother, and she said, "Jim loved your card so much, he ate it." That, to me, was one of the highest compliments I've ever received. He didn't care that it was an original drawing or anything. He saw it. He loved it. He ate it. So there's something about this wholeheartedness. You know, we withhold ourselves from our life. We do things half-heartedly. And in a way, the deepest expression of devotion is to live this life fully, to not miss this moment. What are we devoted to? I mean, when we really sense deeply and we love life, we really want to live it fully. We have all sorts of conditioning to be afraid and hold back, but we want to love fully without holding back. We want to live fully. So this practice of slowing down and remembering what matters, this practice of reaching out towards loving presence, very awake, very noticing what's here, this practice of really living our love is what gives us our life back. I'd like to close again as we have, just with a brief reflection. So if you will, just come sitting however is comfortable. This will be very brief. So we practice intention, what matters. And then sensing the what matters, deep attention to what's right here. And they come together because what matters is what's here. And the more we pay attention to what's here, the more we fall in love with this life. So in these moments, what does it mean to give yourself to the life that's right here? To relax and simply notice sounds. Sensations in the body. To very gently feel your heart. And to offer yourself whatever wish, whatever prayer really resonates in this moment. What do you wish for your life? To feel that field of caring and include someone in your life that matters to you, where you're devoted to the loving that's between you and that person. To sense what it is about them that brings up your loving, their goodness, the light in their eyes, imagining when they smile, how they show you love. And sense your prayer for that person. Feeling the belonging that arises when we open our hearts and include each other. Widening out now to sense those that are in the room, knowing that each, in their own sincerity, cares about awakening, opening, loving more fully. Just holding those that are here in your heart and sensing as a field of presence that it's edgeless, that these awake, empty hearts really include this whole world. That we're really devoted to life, to loving awareness, to the fullness of beingness. To feel our prayer for all beings, that our reflections tonight, our meditation and prayer might be of benefit to all beings, that all beings might realize their very essence as loving presence, inhabiting that essence, living from that fully. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.